But maybe the only one who got the joke was McLuhan, but because he wanted his autograph on that.
Yeah, even, what the fuck, I think Lewis had never read the book either. He believes the hype about it. He said, oh, that's my bad book. I better throw that in the fire. I mean,
don't read this.
I think everybody went bonkers in the 30s under radio conditions. I just think that nobody knew what they were doing. They were still trying to create visual space. It just wasn't working. So they just said, forget it, and went to war, started bombing each other. And then someone made a huge bomb, which before it blew up. So.
Was this like a book, or was that like a pamphlet?
No, it's a book.
Maybe she was not aware.
It's a book. It's for Shadow and Windus, who he had a contract with. I've got the hardback. It's
oh, my. Look at the moon. It's so perfect.
Yeah, tell them how it shines up the bay with the sheen of silver lighting.
Mm. But Lewis probably threw it in the fire because he thought, darn, I tried to be a satirist. I tried to be a comic, and everybody's so stupid. They took it seriously, and they, you know, and then he had to put up with all the craziness about it. He was probably fed up trying to explain himself.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think it's been totally misinterpreted. I mean, I was trying to figure out as we're reading this, where's he going with these paragraphs? I mean, what is he writing them? What's he talking about? He didn't say a topic. That's Manipian satire, to digress all over the place. That's what Manipian satire is.
Well, Bob, we got a hint.
What?
We got a hint of the satire because he was talking about Australia and the people would decide their fate, and he made an exclamation, the people decide their fate, like he couldn't believe it, and that was the hint, like... Okay.
The people called on to decide their fate. What a preposterous notion. I mean, remember, he wrote a book, The Jews, Are They Human? Did you hear Ion talking the Jew jokes? What did he say? Bob's an adjudicator or something? He was making a pun on something earlier tonight. Well, let's see if Ion showed up. Oh, he hasn't showed up yet. Okay.
But he was like a punk. I think he was actually trying to shock the bourgeois, these boring businessmen. And and he went too far with his humor
his
blasting.
Well, he actually started to make a discovery of the new science of media calls. He actually discovers, like me, making a fucking joke for decades, and all of a sudden I come up with the second coming. I mean, could be a little disorienting if you weren't me. I mean, he discovered new knowledge in the middle of making fun of everybody.
He discovered how stupid people are, that they'll believe anything in print.
Damn, you've made that discovery yourself, right, Carol?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob, do you think we missed the jokes from the other parts? Because now I want to go back and re-listen, because I don't remember hearing jokes in the earlier parts of this book.
Well, maybe. Yeah, no, there could be. I'll just go back to page 96. No, listen, you didn't even hear this the first time. You haven't even been around. You've been sleeping. And
what about the page... Read page 69, like McLuhan.
I am. I'm reading page 96. That's what I turned back to. It came to 96. So let's 69 backwards. Here's what it says. There is no humbug so sedulously propagated as that regarding the stupidity of the business magnate. Look at that.
There it is.
That's it. He's pretending that the business magnate is not stupid. It is obvious why it is to that gentleman's advantage to have you believe that he is stupid. Such stupid business magnates do exist, no doubt, but there are but too plainly many who are not stupid at all. It is perhaps safer not to believe too implicitly in this much advertised stupidity. I only throw out a suggestion. You are perfectly at liberty to disregard my caution.
That's perfect.
What a perfect example.
Yeah.
The whole fucking thing. We got to reread the book.
Yep.
We got to do it all over again and laugh.
Uh-oh.
Get more laughs out of it. This is awesome. I'm still trying to look at the way he writes his last paragraph. As to what critical inquiry is, that's italicized, is, if you are not, as you should be, disgusted, you may find that out for yourself. I am not here to teach critical inquiry, of course, nor could I. For if Mr. Thomas Eliot understands nothing at all upon this matter, I understand infinitely less. You know, he can't compare himself to Eliot.
Less than nothing. He understands a lot, which means he understands it all.
Yeah, infinitely less than nothing.
Yeah.
All I can lay claim to now is to recognize a credit crank when I see one. That is enough for me. What is credit crank? I think it is. He's saying people don't understand the new information software economy. Because it went. Yeah.
It's all kind of stupid to him.
Yeah, it's stupid. He says, how can we understand this new virtual society based on credit, on non money? Now, you turn the page after that wondrous page 173, and there is page 174, and it's called The Two Antagonistic Capitalisms. And then opposite is a picture of Dr. Goebbels, the head of propaganda. It's the most absurd fucking picture. This little, worse little punk with a ridiculous expression on his face, with his hands on his hips like he's a spinster in a... in a kindergarten class, just pissed off at the little kids. I mean, it's an incredible picture of credit crankery. I tell you, it's credit crankery. It's obvious this guy's a credit crank. This Dr. Goebbels. Okay, I guess the problem is that if you make a joke about these guys, and you're saying these are the greatest comedians alive today, and then they turn into vicious thugs, killing everybody, that could cause a problem, right? It's the fact that they, by the mid-30s, when Hitler is starting to attack people, it's not so funny what you joked about.
I'm with you, Bob.
Yeah. So,
You've bored everyone else to death, but I'm with you. I woke up just in time.
To save us.
Well, you know, we're here waiting for Ivan to show up.
Well, he was a provocateur.
What?
He was just trying to provoke people.
Yes, he was trying to provoke people. He was trying to...
And he called himself the enemy. Was that before that? Was it before
that? About a year before. He started a magazine called The Enemy in 1928-29. 27 to 29, I think. It ran for 3 years, three issues. And McLuhan used to say in CBC documentaries that he should be regarded as the enemy of society. Yeah, he took on they were going to, I think that was the journal, they were going to continue The Enemy in 1944 in Windsor. Anyways, can I continue reading?
I think he was a product of the new media. All these, he was showing the contradictions of the quadrophenic modern man.
Yep.
And the effects of the new electric environment and
all the stupid rearview mirror ideas everybody had about it. He knew that nobody was getting it right.
He was criticizing it, but at the same time, he was dumbed down by the information he had, or
what'd you say? Dumbfounded? What was that verb?
Dumbed down, like Marinetti. Like they wanted to explore these new expressions of technology, the modern man, the modern life, and somehow that led them to fascism.
Right, and it was confusing. It was they were artists. They took on the challenge of the new, but it was pretty hard to handle. If people had been evolved a million years in the flash of a few seconds with simultaneity, it'd probably get pretty confusing for everybody. What was going on?
And this what we now call the mass culture was being born. And I think on the one side, they were fascinated by that, yeah. But that on the other side...
horrified. You read Lewis's, a really good book is The Art of Being Ruled, written 4 years before this. It's awesome. His analysis of everything is so, makes you think a lot about what it was. It's very perceptive and probably funnier than you realize because it's complex, so you're trying to understand what he's writing. So you don't get the joke right away because you're just trying to figure out what the idea is because he writes awkwardly. Writes well, but it's sort of weird to read it.
Bob, does he write his novels like this with all the digression? I mean, is this just his style?
Oh yeah, he would describe people like a painter, the minutest things. What was I reading? I'm reading Gravity, Thomas Pynchon, and he's like Lewis. His descriptions of people's facial expressions are very idiosyncratic and absurd. That's what Lewis does. You can't even figure out what he's trying. You have to read it a couple times to figure out what is he describing in a person's face. Okay, so let's move on to the two antagonistic capitalisms. Now, what would that be? As regards the financial side of the Hitlerist doctrine, there is no question at all that a violent attack upon the whole technique of credit is contemplated. In their official program, that is made perfectly clear. The furious resistance offered to the Hitlerist rush by the Republican bosses, is largely owing to that particularly extremist credit policy which the NSDAP has steadily refused to jettison. I guess that's the people in power, NSDAP. Without any restraint, the Nazi sees fit to refer to respectable financiers as Beruf's capitalism, who, the Nazi asserts, a bunch of German words, I guess they're putting them down, a bank for these people becomes a stronghold of modern robber barons. So a bank for these people becomes a, quote, stronghold of modern robber barons, unquote. It is small wonder that the Nazi is not very popular. In other words, he's pretty blatant in criticizing the bankers. Then the profiteer, in quotes, his exploits would, in the Third Reich, be punishable with death. He gives a German phrase, and it says, the breaking of credit slavery is their central slogan. Another one, in credit slavery, all peoples and governments find themselves who bow to the might of loan capital. The loan capital is the enemy of enemies, and that is how it is possible for the National Socialists to be upon such good terms with many big industrialists. All proprietorship, that of the little man, look at that, little man, in quotes. All proprietorship, in brackets, that of the little man, especially as against a monopoly or centralized anonymous interest, is to be fanatically protected in the Third Reich. He's going to protect the little man. Against monopoly. Then it quotes...
as we saw, during that time there was such inflation and the banks were creating such chaos that in a way anything that was like trying to solve the chaos that was made by this system...
Mm-hmm.
I think at the beginning might have seemed like an option.
Right. But as McLuhan said, the Nazis were taking the new questions and applying the old tools. They were still rear mirror themselves in their radical solutions.
Yes, and I think the problem was that... I mean, there is a lot of mistakes or problems created by the banks. But the thing with Hitler, he sort of said Banks equals the Jew.
The Jew, and, yeah.
And, well, I think in many, in some aspects, they were not that wrong on what they were saying about credit and how credit legislates.
I don't know what that was.
Credit enslaves humanity.
Yeah, it sounds like you. We're all credit slaves. I've heard you ranting on like that. Right? You've been using the word slavery the past week many times. Well, I want to make a correction. It turns out that NSDAP, capital letters, is not the establishment. It's the Nazis. I figured out what this means. The furious resistance offered to the Hitlerist rush by the Republican bosses is largely owing to that particularly extremist credit policy, which the Nazis had steadily refused to jettison. But it's called the NSDAP, so I don't want to be on record.
I wanted to add that other thing, that the most paradoxical is that nowadays we know who was behind all this. Like, they were financing both sides.
Right. Me and my employers were behind it. That's what's funny. I'm the guy who caused all this shit, and I'm still alive to talk about it and pretend I don't understand it.
Yeah, so
right?
We're hoping that you solve all this.
Yes, I got to solve all this. Somebody's got to solve it.
You set up the Illuminati 800 years ago. Now,
yeah.
Sculpture.
Yeah, it didn't help anybody, and I've now got to leash those guys, reel them back in, put them back in their coffins. I created a monster.
No, but maybe you were creating such pressure on humans so that they would finally shout the thunder. Yeah, no.
Yeah, create the thunder. That's right. I locked them in the black hole of Calcutta.
Call non-physical.
I don't hear Bert laughing. I think that means Bert's left. Yeah, looks like Bert left. We got someone else going to have to start laughing at my jokes. Please. Any volunteers?
There is one.
It's in area code 970. I don't know who that is, but we appreciate your response.
It's Doug. Right.
The old Doug?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, good. Okay, so I appreciate your attempt to explain it, Roxanna, but let me move forward and read some of this complicated stuff.
All right?
So this is quoting from the Nazi program. Quote, so Lewis is quoting from some of the Nazi literature. Our combating of Marxism, our anti-Marxism, is directed against the state-disintegrating teachings of the Jew Karl Marx, against the doctrine of the class war which disrupts the people, against the doctrine of the abolition of private property. That was page 38 of the program of the Nazis. And Lewis says, and in another small book, the handiwork of the editor of the Volkisch Beobachter, the principal National Socialist organ, Marxism is described as working in concert with the international loan capital. So I think they're saying that the capitalists fund the communists. Then they have a quote. Marxism pretended to combat the accursed world capitalism, and yet worked from the outset hand in hand with international great banking and stock exchange interests. See, there's the conspiracy right there.
And it's true.
You're saying we now know behind the scenes. Well, we're just catching up to the Nazis. They knew. They also were funded. They kept that hidden, I guess, or they didn't know they were funded. So, now here's what Lewis says. You are in the presence here of a violence of utterance and an extremism of political conception as great as that of the communists. So he's saying that the Nazis are as bad as the communists. But then he goes, only only there's a quite different orientation in the matter of the main objects of attack. Both attack organized society as it exists in the West today. Both attack capital. How is it then that they should be attacking different things, since surely all capital is the same, and all the existing power of organized society is one, is it not? And if you attack one part of it, then you attack the other. This apparently is not the case. This is like a comedian who's like, you know how comedians, they start stringing together the logic or the illogic of things, and they don't really stop and make a thesis point. They just make you see the absurdity of what they're trying to point out and then move on. That's what he's doing here. He's saying, this is ridiculous. But then he says, this apparently is not the case. The secret seems to lie in the word loan capital. Also, of course, two people may both desire extremely to destroy a given social system, yet each may wish to put totally different things in the place of those destroyed. In an earlier chapter, I insisted upon the fact that Hitler was a sort of inspired German peasant. Is that in italics? In these particular economic teachings, you have the proof of it, I think. The characteristic interests of the peasant proprietor and small trader are here found written all over these programs of reform and are busily at work in every measure outlined therein. So the local chemical body peasant can handle the electrified, angelized, discarnate radio voice. See, they're flailing against this being possessed by the electric environment.
Yes, and I am remembering, I was very surprised to learn that the churches are actually the banks, like
right.
Ian said.
When you're surprised that Ian said it, or you're surprised when you learned it on your own?
No, Ian said.
You mean the Pergamon?
Well, the Pergamon was one of the churches, but all the other churches were also other banks.
Yeah, and that's way back at the time of John the Revelator. You're saying when Ian told us that a few months ago, you were surprised.
Yes, because that's also in the Revelations.
That's right. So you've got the Vatican's a bank. Why wouldn't all these churches be banks all through history?
Yeah, and the priests. I have no idea where I read it, but the priests.
You read it in Harold Innes.
In Innes, right?
Yeah.
Innes would. He talked about the priests would record transactions. That's what they first used the printed word for, to record business transactions. So yeah, they were in the middle of it all.
Well, that's why it's interesting to figure out what Innes is saying, because he's talking about this very point, mm-hmm. and noticing the larger environments that goes beyond the human chemical body response. That's what he's trying to show.
Right. And then who banned usury, which made the Jews,
Christians.
Yeah, the Christians banned usury so that the Jews were the only quote religion that was allowed to offer loans and credit. And then in terms of the peasant remark, yeah, the peasants are the ones that go violent. So,
yeah.
I don't know. If
well, they're in shape. They work hard all day.
But
they got muscles.
Then during the Middle Ages, the Templars take over with this business, and they start to make it international.
Yes.
These loans and yes, it's clear that the banks in antiquity weren't on the temples.
Right. And the
money lenders.
What the Evereen said is that the Arabs started doing usury, even though it was against their religion. And after the Arabs started to get money, build up their power, that's when the Vatican said, screw this, and they started doing usury. And the Evereen said, the Christian Vatican people put the Jews up to be the front man for doing the usury. They made sure that nobody knew this.
Yeah, that's capital. The money is a fallen state because we put the power on this thing. And we
that's
let
right. Now,
this
did you,
system control.
In your life in Berlin the last 20 years, did you go to leftist meetings where Marxists and that would talk about economics and this stuff? Did you ever attend those?
Well, once I tried to read the Capitol, there are like groups that read it.
Yeah, read it. Yeah.
And
you joined a group?
Yes, but I got tired. I didn't make it.
How far did you do it? How many times?
Only a few times.
Right, it's just too boring? You just couldn't do it?
Well, at the time, I was not really interested in economics, but I wanted to know why everybody's talking about this book.
Right.
I mean, I learned a few things, a few terms.
Yes. Right.
But then I didn't make the whole reading.
You dropped out.
Yes, and it's okay. Like the Finnegan's Wake. There are people that are always into
right.
That.
That's right. Okay, let's...
Doug was going to say something.
I was just going to say that it's one of the reasons why I could never get wholeheartedly, shall we say, into the organized religion, church, whether it be Baptist or whatever, which that's what I was raised up in, but very rarely went, only when I could wrangle a ride from neighbors that lived about 2 miles away. Anyway, when I have gone to, like, Catholic churches with friends, most especially my friends here, I've gone to the Catholic churches, and in all of these churches of that nature, I look at all of the opulence that goes into the structure, and the meat of the sermon or the message is about one-third, if not less, than the attempt to pry money from the pockets of the parishioners. And I just never could understand that. In the Bible, Jesus says the doctrine is we're supposed to be giving stuff away to other people and the needy, and we're not supposed to be opulent and, various things of that nature. But it was like the last time I went to church, they were talking about we want to do this, we want to do that, but, quote, we don't have enough money. But we do have enough money, we've just got to pry it out of your pockets.
Hmm. Well, what you saw has been a common complaint for 2,000 years. So.
Yeah,
but that's why... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Dick.
Carla.
Yeah, we're waiting for you, Carol.
No, we're not. Are we?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's important. I certainly kind of know that, but it's really important to express that because, we've heard how the Vatican, so you just have to look at the structures there to know how much money they do have and how much money they collected. So, the church has all the money. The church in all the tiny villages had the hugest edifices. So that's where the money ended up. So, it's important to recognize that. It goes on today. And I grew up in a Baptist environment myself at one point. So I know it was always about, we have no money, and, you have to give it to us. So the less land condition just made them more poor and more sick, actually. So they never really got anything out of it. So that's my little sidebar ramble.
Well, supportive,
right. They never actually achieved or imparted in any way into the doctrine that they were spilling. And, that's one of the reasons why it resonated so well with me and so high with me when talking or listening to Bob and listening to Ion and some of the others. Why it resonated with so much with me, because that's what I have thought in my own mind over the years and why I never really participated so much in the church. I wasn't even baptized until I was 68 years old. And I didn't, up until then, I always resisted that. And then I did meet one preacher in Colorado that resonated with me, and I understood more of what he said better than any other preacher that I've known. And I looked at what he did in his daily life and the way he did it, and that connected with me enough to go through a baptism ceremony under his hand, so to speak.
Okay, well, I want to read here. We're talking about the German peasant is attracted to the Hitler. Somebody want to mute themselves? He's got that sound, cooking sound or something. The characteristic interests of the peasant, proprietor, and small trader are here found written all over these programs of reform and are busily at work in every measure outlined therein. But there is this paradox. It's like Doug's paradox. It is one of the first difficulties in understanding who is who in this particular melee. This paradox is one of the first difficulties in understanding who is who in this particular melee. The interest of the industrialist, so it seems, is in many ways identical with that of the peasant, or at least it can be made to accommodate itself to the latter. That is certainly contrary to what one would expect. In the political activities of the greatest of all industrialists, Henry Ford, however, you had a startling proof of that fact. For the enemy of Ford, as transpired in his violent manifestos of a few years ago, was, oddly enough, precisely that loan capital so much disliked by the Hitlerists. Ford's fellow citizens at the time said, with a laugh, that they guessed Ford had had, at the start, when he was in a small way of business, some bitter disagreements with the banks. That was the explanation for them of his behavior. However that may be, you have a strange similarity between what would be the recommendations for economic reform advanced by the world's richest man, that capitalist of capitalists, in brackets paying an income tax in conjunction with his son Edsel, amounting to almost £1 million a year, and then the similarity between him and the Germanic Bauarbeiter Adolf Hitler, whose economics doubtless issue from the fundamental requirements and ambitions of the German peasant class with their instinct to protect and to increase their tiny capitals. And there you have also, at Hitler's side, if further proof were needed, the great German industrialist Hugenberg. Looking at these plain facts from the outside, as the merest ignorant spectator, so he's calling himself the merest ignorant spectator, Lewis is, there does seem some peculiar and significant cleavage between those who own something tangible, like a farm large or small, or a factory large or small, and those who own nothing concrete, but whose métier is the intangible quantities of speculative wealth. The financier, pure and simple, for whom a definition of wealth would be simply debt, as is the case with most orthodox economists. So he's saying there is some peculiar cleavage between those who own something tangible like a farm, the peasant guy, large or small, or a factory large or small, and those who own nothing, the financier.
Yeah, and that's LaRouche's point again.
Right. Cleavage, but he's saying, the virtual software, as the money starts to get virtualized in the electric environment, it is upsetting the chemical bodies, even the chemical bodies of rich capitalists. So those that the bankers, they own nothing concrete, but whose métier is the intangible quantities of speculative wealth. The financier, pure and simple, for whom a definition of wealth would be simply debt, as is the case with most orthodox economists. Between these two things, there does seem to be a great deal of instinctive hostility. And the National Socialist appears, if I understand them rightly, to regard Karl Marx, and hence communism, as a revolutionary, left-wing or left-hand, representative of the loan capital, and to regard himself, that resurgent Hitlerist, as the equally revolutionary representative of all that other capital that is work, or that is the product of some concrete act of creation. So those are the two capitalisms, loan capitalism and forget the other one's title that came up in the previous way, many pages back there. It is not surprising under these circumstances to find him drawing up the most ghastly penalties for the stockbroker. Of course, who does love a stockbroker? When people read that the Monegascus have violently protested against the rather overwhelming part that the casino at Monte Carlo and its patrons play in their lives, no one feels great sympathy with the Prince of Monaco and his clients. The Monegascus seem to most people to be in the right to protest. Even more forcibly, who but can help sometimes wondering whether that other description of casino at the Bourse in Paris or at Wall Street, where the stakes are the industry and intelligence of vast populations of men and all that they potentially are or can do, is quite as unexceptional an establishment as some people would have us believe. For the most languid economist among us, and I am the world's languidest, I am certain, look at that. Little joke there. And I am the world's languidest, I am certain. There is nothing very attractive in that stupendous playfulness of bull and of bear. Let me read that again. Even more forcibly, who but can help sometimes wondering whether that other description of casino, the Bourse in Paris or at Wall Street, where the stakes are the industry and intelligence of vast populations of men and all that they potentially are or can do, is quite as unexceptionable an establishment as some people would have us believe. For the most languid economist among us, and I am the world's languidest, I am certain, there is nothing very attractive in that stupendous playfulness of bull and of bear. But that is an instinctive reaction merely. I have not the knowledge that is necessary to confirm this with an argued opinion. If I knew more, I might perceive that I had been mistaken. A credit crank whom I have lying upon my table explains, quote, so some pamphlet, can one tolerate any longer a condition of affairs in which the bankers or the stock gamblers of New York, London, Amsterdam, Frankfurt, and Paris vie amongst themselves for the privilege of the better pillaging of the poor world? Unquote. Oh, these credit cranks. The scoundrel is a bore. It is an old story. Still, if stock and share gambling were stopped, I should not passionately regret it. I do not feel inclined to condemn a party like that of Hitler because I find out that they would make it hot for the stock jobber. It is a negative attitude, but at least I do not regard the closing of the casino in the Place de Bourse. But at least I do not regard the closing of the casino in the Place de la Bourse as in itself either a stupid or a wicked action. It depends what comes after that and why it is done. Yeah, it sounds reasonable. Well, Lewis is for disrupting these environments.
And, you know, it kind of explains a little bit, Lewis was criticized, you know, in the Sidney and Violet book at that age. They criticized Lewis for taking money from rich patrons and then abusing those patrons.
Satirizing them.
Yeah, satirizing them. So he had use for money, but he had no use for the money lenders or the people of wealth. He was satirizing them right from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, the schizophrenia of the literate world was totally caught off guard by the implosion of electricity, contradictory modalities.
Mm-hmm.
It's like McLuhan would say that nobody got free of having a conflict of interest.
Nobody escaped unscathed.
Yeah, they're inside two contradictory environments.
Mm-hmm. And probably the extreme behavior of that age was precisely because the electric environment exploded a whole new generation on the old rich money generation, and they just couldn't take it. And
right.
It all went crazy, and as we saw in those Sin City movies. Or
yeah.
Documentaries.
Yeah, people were drugged by the discarnate, by the non-bodied.
Hmm. Cool.
So we'll carry on. So the last chapter of this section, which is called Hitlerist Economics. So we read today War Debts and the Great Creditor Nation America, Choosing Your Change, Are You a Credit Crank, credit crankery rampant, the two antagonistic capitalisms, and then misery spot or golden age. He has the phrase little man again in here. I was quoting Lewis all along, or something from that era, the little man. What?
Oh, sorry, Bob. I said wow. I'm unmuted.
Okay. You're wowing at the fact that the little man is a term used here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing, and it's pretty hard to believe that he got the reputation from this book. Nobody read the book.
That's right. Did you hear us laughing about it half an hour ago?
No.
The joke? It turns out it's a satire, or there are satirical parts. Yeah, you got to hear that in the recordings. It's pretty good what we discovered about it. We may have to reread the whole thing now knowing it was a satire.
I really wanted to ask, will you just start over, Bob? Because I fell asleep, and this is a part of the show I don't want to miss these days.
Well, it's on. You'll get the recording. So
I know.
Misery Spot or Golden Age, Section 6 in Part 5. Now, as to the Hitler attitude to the small proprietor or master workman or little trader discussed in the last chapter. In the past, I had written a good deal about the little man. So that means he uses that phrase a lot, and his ways. In the past, I've written a good deal about the little man and his ways, and has been mainly against that undersized individual. You know, Lewis mocks the little man. I have no love for the little man as such, yet it may be that I did not discriminate clearly enough at that time between the different manifestations of his opposite. The great, in short, all that is opposite to the little man is not so very good. Also, there are little men and little men, no doubt. I have no undying hatred for a shrewd, industrious peasant. I do not wish to shake my fist at him if I detect him saving money. And sometimes the fellow dances. I delight in the more interesting of his dances. They are very pleasant. Look at that. Look at this cheeky way he's writing. I like them far better than a bottom-wagging jazz, which is the folk dance of the megalopolis. Gone nigger and gone underdog for good, choked and gurgling with deep cheap pathos, and he's got nigger in quotes, gone nigger and gone underdog for good, choked and gurgling with cheap pathos, close bracket. It is the little megalopolis, now this is interesting, so he's talking about different kinds of little men. It is the little megalopolitan who is, I think, in fact, the worst of all the little men. A really fine peasant is scarcely small at all. There is no one less likely than myself to indulge in sentiment regarding the peasant, but let us give all men their due. I do not, however, want to reopen that discussion in this place. All I wish to say is that I agree with much of the criticism of the Hitlerist directed against communism, which has taken the mechanical ways of the megalopolis over into the villages. But especially the Hitlerist criticism seems to me to ring true when it attacks the substitution by the communists of the notion of quantity for that of quality. For instance, and he quotes, in the raw materialistic Marxian worldview, which substituted for the idea of quality, the purely lifeless idea of quantity, so the raw materialistic Marxian substituted quality with the purely lifeless idea of quantity, which denied the worth of creative personality. End of quote, in bracket. Upon some points, of course, the communists and the National Socialists are in considerable agreement. Ultimately, the reason why their two doctrines could never fuse is this. The Marxist or communist is a fanatically dehumanizing doctrine. Its injunctions are very rigidly erected against the continuance of the person. Person in quotes. In the place of the person, the communists would put the thing, quantity, in place of quality, as it is stated above. It seems to me that in these matters, however, it is a question largely of application. The communist cannot be said to be all wrong by any means in his attitude to personality. Personality in quotes. There's a great deal of second-rate quality or of personality which would be far better eliminated. Where the dogma of communism is bad, in my view, is in its insistence upon the elimination of the very principle itself, of successful as well as unsuccessful exemplars. So even if Hitlerism, in its pure Germanism, might retain too much personality of a second-rate order, nevertheless, Hitlerism seems preferable to communism, which would have none at all if it had its way. Personality is the only thing that matters in the world, but there is very little of it that matters, for the very good reason that most of it is spurious or feeble. But there is one enormous difference between National Socialist theory and its first cousin credit crankery upon the one side and communist theory upon the other. And that, psychologically, is, I think, of the greatest importance. The Weltanschauung of the Hitlerist, or his near relation, the egregious credit crank, is laughing and gay compared to that of his opponent, the communist. The communist world picture is painted in crude, blood, red, coal-black colors. But if what the cranky Hitlerist believes is true, a veritable golden age is in store for the world, if only the incubus of Das loan capital could be removed. The so-called idealism of the National Socialist consists in believing that this nightmare can ever be driven out, not surely in the pleasantness of life once it were. What's this? The so-called idealism of the National Socialist consists in believing that this nightmare can ever be driven out, not surely in the pleasantness of life once it were. So the idealism is about getting rid of the National Socialists, believing that it could be done.
Getting rid of money.
Oh, yeah. The so-called idealism of the Nazi consists in believing that this nightmare can never be driven out. Right. The Nazi has his optimism. Not surely in the pleasantness. His idealism is not about the pleasantness of life once it is driven out.
And by calling it idealism, he implies that it's not going to happen. I would think.
No, that's what they... Yeah, others may call the Nazis idealists.
I think Lewis is saying it's not going to happen. We're not going to be able to drive out credit and loans and all that. I mean, that's just, it's a given, but he's explaining that's sort of what Hitler's agenda is, and everybody's forgetting the electric environment and how the megalopolis has gone all crazy electric, and the peasants therefore look better for a moment, but they're all little men, so nobody's going to get anywhere.
Yeah. This National Socialist is optimistic, idealistic about stopping the credit world, not necessarily idealistic about the pleasantness of life once it were. So that's supporting what you're just saying. That
was part of Hitler's propaganda to get rid of credit, loans and credit?
Yeah. Or... Yes, they're credit cranks, maybe. There's a whole funny part on credit crankery, which Lewis goes on and on about, then in the end decides he doesn't know what the fuck it is.
Or that was what the Nazis set up right from the beginning to create a scapegoat of the people who were giving credit and loans, which just happened to be the Jews. So, there was part of the agenda was let's create a scapegoat to fight against. You know, everybody in power has to do that. They have to have somebody to fight. They have to have a war. So they created the war within Germany against the Jews. And they made it about money.
And Innes says, the hidden part was the effect of radio made one crowd be a figure against the other crowd. So there was an effect of radio that made the Jews look bad for a totally different reason. The radio imploded. It gave everybody an identity crisis. So they had to find a scapegoat, not because it's the human nature to find a scapegoat, but the radio environment caused the problem. Cause the discomfort.
Yeah, and Marx was German born.
No, I think
so
he grew up
native
in Cyprus.
Well, I'm wondering if the people of Germany in the time of Lewis, you know, Marx
Not
was
Cyprus,
in there.
Corsica, maybe Corsica. What were you saying?
Well, would German people have an affinity towards Marx because he was from the homeland, that he was German? And so when Hitler came in, part of Hitler's propaganda was using that argument of communism versus, they didn't even call it capitalism back then, did they? That economic...
Maybe. No, you're right. He was born in the Kingdom of Prussia. Where did I get this idea about the Corsican thing? Did he move there?
He studied in Bonn and Berlin.
Let's see.
Where is his early life?
No, and you're right. He's largely grows up in German. But...
Well, and that's what I'm wondering. Did the... So Marx was... The people of Germany had Marx in their history and their background. And Hitler used, as part of his propaganda, the argument of communism versus capitalism that used...
So what are you trying to
economics.
Say? Okay, the German people liked Marx.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to say that Hitler had that kind of environment in Germany. And the propaganda that he developed...
Hitler was against Marxism and capitalism.
Yeah. But he used that argument to build an argument against the Jews. He basically, made up the stuff about the Jews by using the argument that was already in play of communism versus the free hand of Adam
right.
Smith or whatever it was called.
So, what was it? The Illuminati view is that there's a faction, very powerful faction in Germany, or in that part of Europe, that funded both the right and the left.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Illuminati idea. And it happened that they're all in Germany. That's the area where this can be done. It can involve turning taxes or the Prussians. But somebody made a big deal out of Marx in Corsica or Cyprus.
Just Google Marx and Corsica. But, that's the way most of these political, financial mm-hmm. struggles go, is somebody funds both sides and just destabilizes it's just destabilization so that the third power can take over or keep in power.
I missed what you said.
The business about funding both sides, that's the common MO, modus operandi, of any organization
yeah.
who wants to stay in control. They fund both opposing sides, both opposing sides lose money and followers, and then the people behind the scenes keep their power.
Yeah.
And that's been kind of a consistent game plan for a very long time, right? That's been kind of the simple plan, the simple strategy that's consistent.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a huge distraction. So,
yep.
Lewis understands some of this, and that's where the satirical aspect of the book became obvious a while ago, and we all burst into hysterics.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Well, I have that to look forward to then.
Okay, I want to keep reading. Thank you, Dr. Dean, for the saying of appraisal of the conspiracy.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Dean.
Yes, I'm a victim of it myself, so I understand.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. Okay, I get it. Okay, back off.
Yeah. Okay, so where were we? Okay, Beck. The Welton Schwang
idealism.
Of the Hitlerist. Yeah. But there is one enormous difference between National Socialist theory and its first cousin, Credit Crankery, upon the one side, and Communist theory upon the other. And that psychologically is, I think, of the greatest importance. The Welton Schwang of the Hitlerist, or his near relation, the egregious Credit Crank, is laughing and gay compared to that of his opponent, the Communist. The Communist world picture is painted in crude blood red, coal black colors. But if what the cranky Hitlerist believes is true, a veritable golden age is in store for the world, if only the incubus of Das loan capital could be removed. The so-called idealism of the National Socialists consists in believing that this nightmare can ever be driven out, not surely in the pleasantness of life once it were. So we read that before. On principle, for his is a deliberately catastrophic philosophy, the word is Marx's, the Communist views everything in the darkest colors. Everything for him is difficult and incredibly bitter and black. His is the romantic, the stormy palette. The Credit Crank, on the other hand, as is perhaps only natural with a partly deranged intelligence, is wildly sanguine. The Hitlerist dream is full of an imminent classical serenity, leisure, and abundance. It is with them misery spot against golden age. Here again I, says Lewis, as an artist, plump for the golden age. As an academic economist, if I were that, I should, I am sure, be all upon the side of a bitter and dreary struggle for bare existence. For the popular economist, one notices, who is always in the nature of things a spokesman of the great financial interest, everything is always particularly dreary and difficult. That's for the economist. We may just succeed in scraping through the present overwhelming period of depression. In brackets, he speaks about it as though it were an atmospheric phenomenon, not the doing of men of flesh and blood. That's why his lucubrations are named a science. We may just succeed, on condition that we immediately knock off cigarettes, all alcoholic drinks, dog racing, etc., etc. Rigid economy and still more rigid economy until I suppose we have become helots and until there is nothing more to knock off at all. Check this, helot. What's a helot? Helot. A member of a class of serfs in ancient Sparta, intermediate in status between slaves and citizens. The National Socialist would say in this connection that it was only when things were black and people in great difficulties that loan capital had its opportunity. Also, it is obvious that communism could not exist without great misery and patent injustice. The anthropologist employs the term misery spot, that's in quotes, to describe a district where the barrenness of the soil, remoteness, and other prohibitive conditions have caused the few inhabitants to become a stunted, animal-like, backward, and wretched community. But today, if the present unsettled and harassing conditions are worsened and prolonged, we may expect the whole earth to become, from the human standpoint, one vast misery spot. Trade revival, in quotes, as everybody knows by now, is a chimera. Psychologically, if not physically, the peoples of the whole earth, whether it be China, Germany, Russia, Australia, have entered into the shadow of misery, of mental misery, and in the case of many nations or portions of nations, of physical misery as well. Now, in the light of the beliefs I have been exposing, this misery is purely and absolutely artificial. It is the result not of an actual, a natural want, but of an artificially fostered, sedulously contrived want. Obviously, there is no real want. There is an enormous abundance of everything. If men's technical power to produce were made use of and put at the disposal of all, there he sounds like Bucky Fuller, but for some reason or other, we have slowly been conducted into such a state of affairs that, in the lap of plenty, we have agreed to starve. And the science of economics, as usually practiced, does certainly seem to be there merely in order to confuse us and to throw dust in our eyes. The best illustration of how such an artificial state of want can be brought about, and that very suddenly, if necessary, is prohibition in the United States. The untold miseries and absurdities of prohibition need not be cataloged here. What you get with prohibition is this, then. You have the earth groaning with admirable vines covered with grapes, asking nothing better than to be transformed by thousands of skilled workmen into excellent and health-giving finishes. But man, some small group of men, by means of some senseless verboat, man prohibits this. So there is supposed to be no wine or intoxicating liquor of any sort. This fiction is embodied in a form of law apparently so sacrosanct that it cannot be reversed, even when it has become plain to everybody that its strict enforcement is impossible, and that its continuance must mean the creation of a particularly wasteful and destructive criminal class, of endless loss of time and money and danger to the nation's health. But a man-made law must stand, however much men suffer. Then that's the last bit. Everything
wow,
is by human agency. What?
He was one of the most important prophets of our time.
Yep.
That last section you're reading describes right now.
Right. He influenced both Innes and McLuhan, who...
Well, and even Baudrillard, he said, misery is purely artificial. And
right.
It seems like Baudrillard just took that and ran with that statement.
Hmm. Everything is by human agency made difficult, where everything, if it were only mature, that man had to deal with, would be superlatively easy. Everything is by human agency made difficult, where everything would be superlatively easy, if it were only nature that man had to deal with. See, you've got to deal with more than nature. You've got to deal with the electric environment. The sort of argument you will hear from the Hitlerists is this. You will say, the amount of manpower available for productive work in England, for instance, in 1800, was all told only about the equivalent of what any single moderate-sized power station has at its disposal today. And this
power
immensely
station?
Multiplied. Yeah.
Okay.
A moderate-sized power station had its disposal of a certain number of men. The sort of argument you will hear from the Hitlerists is this. He will say, the amount of manpower available for productive work in England, for instance, in 1800, was all told only about the equivalent of what any single moderate-sized power station has at its disposal today. If this immensely multiplied power and skill we now possess, thanks to the constantly perfected technique of industry, were made full use of, a large proportion of the population would literally have no work to do at all. You see...
Wow.
You would have to find them work. Hand industries could be brought back or something of that sort. Meanwhile, the dream of the Utopians would actually today have come true. Utopian proposals for the life beautiful and all the rest of it, life beautiful in quotes, would be in full force. Utopian proposals for the life beautiful and all the rest of it would be in full force if it were not for this artificial state of difficulty and of want. That's very much like LaRouche there. So say these excellent people I've been introducing you to in these pages close down the private banks, abolish the ridiculous debts we all owe to each other all around, for all the howitzers and poison gas we killed each other with 10 years. Close down the private banks, abolish the ridiculous debts we all owe to each other all around for all the howitzers and poison gas we killed each other with 10 years ago. Release credit, and the most colossally golden age of any yet would be upon us. It would be such a golden age as man has never either passed through or so much as imagined. It would be such a golden age as man has never either passed through or so much as imagined. And there is nothing at all difficult or idealistic about it, except that there are a small minority of people who have legal rights over us, and they desire, owing to their power complexes, unquote, to keep us poor and in difficulties. So.
That's it?
Wow.
No, but why, this is the thing about you. I can't remember how to say it. People are small.
Little men.
And then the industry comes in. And what was that about the industry?
Well, it gets taken over by capital and then subsumed. But what I was going to say is It's like Lewis knew all this. He knew about money. He knew about prohibition, the ridiculousness of like Ion says, trying to set rules on moral behavior. And so Lewis had his own personal agenda. He sees Hitler and the gang as a possibility of opening this up, and it's not so much supporting Hitler as supporting Lewis's own ideas,
yeah,
and trying to get them across. But then Hitler turned out to be such a monster, people just look at him, quote, and supporting these excellent people.
Mm.
And then the whole argument was lost. And they did the same to Pound when Pound was going on about capitalism and everything.
Well, the bankers.
Bankers, yeah.
So, talking about...
And they did the same thing to Lennon, John Lennon.
Yeah, right.
To speak out, you know, your head is cut off, and they did the same to me.
Right.
I understand.
I got away. They never caught me.
No, I protected you, Bob.
You never protected me.
I had your ankle.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you so much. It really has been as simple as I thought it was all along.
What was? You know, it's not simple. What nuttiness are you getting yourself into, Gene, again?
Just very, very simple, that we have all the abundance we've ever desired, but there's been something in the way all along, and it's just a whole layer of confusion that's created.
Well, that's the contrast. We create the contrast so we know how good it is.
Yeah, that keeps us from, realizing how good it is. We can only dream about how good it is because, we create the layer of confusion that keeps us away from what we dream about.
Our technologies numb us, so people... You know, they're on welfare, and they get in their car, and they listen to the radio, and all this technological abundance is happening in the 20th century, even though they have no visible means of support. It's the wealth of these post-moneyed environments. You got a car, man, you can move around
and
distract
you
yourself from your hunger.
You can read that last section. You know, you could read that last session or put it on Facebook today, and those words all apply today. You know, replace grapes for marijuana. You know, you can,
right.
I'm thinking of, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, here's the part. Lewis says, meanwhile, the dream of the utopians would actually today have come true. Utopian proposals for the life beautiful and all the rest of it would be in full force if it were not for this artificial state of difficulty and of want. So, say these excellent people I've been introducing you to in these pages close down the private banks, abolish the ridiculous debts we all owe to each other all around for all the howitzers and poison gas we killed each other with 10 years ago. Release credit, and the most colossally golden age of any yet would be upon us. It would be such a golden age as man has never either passed through or so much as imagined. And there's nothing at all difficult or idealistic about it, except that there are a small minority of people who have legal rights over us, and they desire, owing to their power complexes, to keep us poor and in difficulties. Lewis ends by saying, all I can say is this. If I were to go into this matter at all thoroughly, if I found that the blamable and unworthy credit crank had made me dream this dream without justification, he would have to reckon with me pronto. But meanwhile, it is legitimate to hope that, although all the ravings of this madman are not to be taken quite seriously, yet there may be something in what he says after all. All does not seem quite in order, does it, with the system from which the spokesman come to tell us not to listen to this crazy optimist. There's perhaps a chance. What then? Read that again. All does not seem quite in order, does it, with the system from which the spokesmen come to tell us not to listen. What are you doing, Carolyn? Are you going to mute or what? Mute. Okay, let me try this again. But meanwhile, it is legitimate to hope that, although all the ravings of this madman are not to be taken quite seriously, yet there may be something in what he does say after all. All does not seem quite in order, does it, with the system from which the spokesmen come who tell us not to listen to this crazy optimist? There is perhaps a chance. What then? So then there's the conclusion. How many pages is that?
Well, right there he's saying that, he's not agreeing with everything Hitler says. He would just like to hope that there's something to be optimistic about.
Yeah. So there's one section left, the conclusion. Should I read the conclusions?
Yeah.
Seven or eight pages.
Sure.
Finish it up?
Yep.
Okay. All right, conclusion. I have placed Hitler and his political doctrine before you to the best of my ability and hope that as a result of this essay, the German nation may, here and there, be a little better understood by us. The effort should really be made, for the German destiny is bound up with ours much more than is that, for instance, of cosmopolitan France, which in any event is much more accessible to the average Englishman and so less likely to be misread. I read that last sentence. The effort should really be made, for the German destiny is bound up with ours much more than is that, for instance, of cosmopolitan France, which in any event is much more accessible to the average Englishman and so less likely to be misread. Hitler is not without intelligent support in England. The other day, even, a man very prominent in the social world of London remarked to me that the German, ostracized throughout the world since the conclusion of the war, with a vast class suddenly impoverished by inflation, had suffered from a growing inferiority complex. Of that, he asserted Hitler was curing his fellow countrymen. Eventually, he believed Hitler would succeed in restoring her soul to Germany. Intact. Sir Oswald Mosley recently, in the course of a speech at Rochester, pointed out that there had never, in fact, been any democracy in England at all. He might, of course, have added that there had never been any democracy anywhere. The democracy of the city-states of antiquity was governed by a relatively small caste of freemen, in quotes and then brackets, whose privileges ultimately were based upon race, as most privilege has been in the world up to the present.
Bob?
Yes.
Did you fall asleep?
No, I was just trying to figure out where, what I had read and what to say next. I'm going to read this last paragraph.
No.
Sir Oswald Mosley, remember, is the leader of the fascists, and he's writing about Lewis knew him. Sir Oswald Mosley recently, in the course of a speech at Rochester, pointed out that there had never, in fact, been any democracy in England at all. He might, of course, have added that there had never been any democracy anywhere. The democracy of the city-states of antiquity was governed by a relatively small caste of freemen whose privileges ultimately were based upon race, as most privilege has been in the world up to the present, at the expense of a slave or helot population. It was an idyllic democracy for the ruling class. Democracy, in quotes, in England, and parliamentarism, therefore, as practiced upon the continent of Europe, meant merely the Punch and Judy show of Tory and of Whig. For the benefit of the population of England, a small privileged landed class indulged in a strange declamatory political game in which fists were shaken and high words exchanged. It was at times highly dramatic, and great actors have trod that model parliamentary British stage. The English people were the spectators. The actors were invariably members of the ruling class. But for the purposes of the plot, the actors were conventionally divided in two great factions, called Tory and Whig. Let's see, where are we?
Well, up until now, I think the whole presentation he made of Hitler and his ideology is very superficial. He has some insights, for example, about banking, about this democracy never really existing, and Hitler also being like a British agent. But he's not talking about really the ideology and anything else. I mean, he doesn't.
He's talking about the complexity the technologies were bringing in.
And he's promoting his own agenda on the back of Hitler.
Apparently, but he's saying, hey, we got to think about this clearer. And he deals with the particular puny issues that I've over race and the Jew and that. He maybe is sincere.
But I mean, I don't blame him because, I mean, even nowadays we're still fascinated. We have this fascination about that whole era.
Yeah.
And there are so many aspects that can be studied, like the occult and different aspects of what was going on that makes it so interesting, or the issues about race and they also use psychics, and they thought, I mean, in a way they were not that wrong with the question about the blood, and they were looking for all these objects, and
yeah,
they wanted their power, but they
okay. But look at what he's saying here. What's coming up
what,
here?
What is that really?
He's pointing
mean?
To the obsolescence of everything, and he says the Hitlers, they see the obsolescence of the present setup, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. Now, let me just read some more here, so you get a little more information. He says, it was at times, democracy in England and parliamentarism, therefore, as practiced upon the continent of Europe, meant merely the Punch and Judy show of Tory and of Whig. For the benefit of the population of England, a small privileged landed class indulged in a strange declamatory political game in which fists were shaken and high words exchanged. It was at times highly dramatic, and great actors have trod that model parliamentary British stage. The English people were the spectators. The actors were invariably members of the ruling class. But for the purpose of the plot, the actors were conventionally divided into two great factions called Tory and Whig, the latter gentleman pretending to be in a great rage or a towering passion, that's the Whigs, with the former because they were so very conservative. Now, Lewis says, that game is dead and done with. It was over long ago. Mr. Baldwin and his merry men, or rather his very taciturn and gloomy men, is no more a Tory than he is a Whig. How could he be? There's no such thing as a Tory today in the nature of things. This is not the age of Pendennis. Conservative is indeed a gross misnomer. As a matter of simple fact, there's nothing left to conserve. You know, in the 60s, everybody was trying to say there's no difference between left and right, or that they're both useless. Here's Lewis doing it way back in the 30s, saying the terms are limited. Now, what did you say about Hitler being a British agent, and what did you say about Lewis in relation to that?
Well,
Lewis knew that?
He was saying this British person told him about Hitler being an agent? Did I?
An early part of the book, you mean?
Yes, you just read that a while ago.
Someone told him what?
Before you talk about the democracy, how there is no democracy, and democracy was only a minority and was based on race.
Right.
He commented that somebody told him he was being supported by the British.
Did I say that? That someone told Lewis that who was being supported by the British?
Hitler.
Well, I don't see that in here. That's what LaRouche said. And yeah, LaRouche said that. I don't know if I didn't hear, you misheard that. I don't remember saying that idea because Lewis is not saying it. The oligarchy, maybe the whole European oligarchy is the.
Go a little back because I think you even repeated.
Right, the democracy of the city-states of antiquity was governed by a relatively small caste of freemen.
No, but before that,
Bob, there was a sentence that said German destiny is bound up with ours much more than it is of France.
Yes, because.
Oh, that sentence. Yeah, let me see.
There is the Anglo-Saxon connection. It's
right.
Like the same.
Yeah, here it is. It's
origin.
The opening of the conclusion. I have placed Hitler and his political doctrine before you to the best of my ability and hope that as a result of this essay, the German nation may here and there be a little better understood by us. The effort should really be made, for the German destiny is bound up with ours much more than it is that, for instance, of cosmopolitan France, which in any event is much more accessible to the average Englishman and so less likely to be misread. So, yeah, he's saying there's something similar in the Protestants of the Germans and the Protestants of the... British. He doesn't say the Protestants.
There is also a common origin, like Anglo-Saxons were a tribe, and they divided, and some went to England. The Anglos and the Saxons stayed here in Germany.
Right. Okay, I'm going to move along here. He's saying that there's no... The Punch and Judy of the Whig and Tory was of the same order of humbug, neither less nor more, as the, quote, dictatorship of the proletariat. Hey, Carolyn, are you muted?
No.
Okay. The Tsar Stalin is the dictator, and he says, le proletariat, c'est moi. American democracy. American.
Because absolute kings will say, l'état c'est moi, the state is me.
Yeah.
And he was saying.
He's saying the whole. The millions of working people are me.
Here comes
but you
everybody.
Can do that. You can do that because you're communicating to everybody through radio. You see? There's the simultaneity of the mass man.
Must we continue to mow down the Kennedys?
In order to show that the hot politics of politics did not work in the cool medium of TV. The Punch and Judy of the Whig and Tory was of the same order of humbug, neither less nor more, as the dictatorship of the proletariat. The Tsar Stalin is the dictator, and he says, le proletariat, c'est moi. American democracy is another political facade of that sort. Stalin's democracy is suited for ex-serfs. Hoover's, isn't he Carl's, he's not talking about J. Edgar Hoover, he's talking about Herbert Hoover was president, late 20s, early 30s, or maybe he means J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover's for Anglo-Saxon traditions, so Stalin's democracy is suited for ex-serfs. Hoover's democracy is suited for Anglo-Saxon traditions of the home of the brave and the free order. Hoover's for Anglo-Saxon traditions of the home of the brave and the free order. Under the circumstances, why throw up your hands in horror, Mr. Democrat, when confronted with Mussolini, Pilsudski, or Hitler? See, here's he's not too impressed with bourgeois democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Under the circumstances, why throw up your hands in horror, Mr. Democrat, when confronted with Mussolini, Pilsudski, or Hitler? Of those gentlemen... If those gentlemen are typical of the community out of which they rise to the position of supreme authority, more or less, that should be enough for you. Unadulterated democracy being quite impossible. But in Germany's case, a real political novelty has come about. The German nation has a chance at present of voting for its future tyrant. Perhaps the German people... Look, he's saying Hitler's a tyrant.
Wow. Oh, wow.
They have the chance to vote for their future tyrant. Perhaps the German people are today nearer to true democracy, who knows, than any European nation has ever been at all. The English, at least, have never had such an opportunity. So he's saying that these people came out of the people. They came out of the masses. That's democracy.
Yes, and he says there is no real democracy, so at least Germans had the chance of choosing their tyrant.
Well, he's talking about electric democracy, mass man, where everybody participates and anybody can take over, whereas the literate bureaucracy kind of democracy of the 19th century is ineffectual. It's what Bakun called the new participation. The masses could participate in politics and not be subject to the oligarchs controlling it in the 19th century.
And he is labeling Hitler as a tyrant, but because we're all little men, then that's what we deserve.
Right. Okay, can you...
Yep.
Mute...